Welcome to Attention Confidential, the podcast where we explore deep self-awareness, bold curiosity, and passionate advocacy for both ourselves and our communities.
In support of safety, please be advised that this podcast contains explicit language and direct or indirect references to material which some listeners may find triggering. Please prioritize your safety and the safety of those around you who may be exposed to this material, especially young folks. Please also note, this is an ongoing project, which means I am actively engaged in learning while creating. The format, the tools, and skills to produce this material are all new to me. As I build and refine, I ask that you understand there may be kinks along the way. And because transparency is one of my core values, I should also share that I am using software that includes enhanced features to simplify the editing and post-production process. Any editing of this content, however, this original, organic, human-generated content, is done so at my discretion, specifically to optimize sound quality, not to manipulate, omit, or alter any substantive material in the recordings. You can find more details about each guest and relevant resources in the show notes for each episode.
Hey, weirdos and queerdos, and welcome to another episode of Attention Confidential, the podcast where we explore self-awareness, curiosity, and advocacy in a safe container. I am your host, Maggie Green, here to remind you that your voice matters and your stories are safe with me. Sharing our identities with others is such a generous gift, and today's guest has chosen to share theirs with us. Before I reveal to you who they are, here are a few things to know about today's guest. This person uses she, they pronouns, is a consultant and small business coach, an internationally recognized expert in the fashion industry, and the host of one of my favorite podcasts ever, which you might remember hearing about a little bit in episode 2, Clothes Horse, aka the podcast for people who love fashion but hate capitalism. Which is actually how we met way back in 2020. Best of all, they are a trusted friend and colleague with whom I always have the most inspiring conversations, both on record and off. Their name is Amanda. Welcome to the show, Amanda. Thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us here, and of course for being willing to let me put you in the hot seat this time. Would you like to get us started by telling listeners a little bit more about yourself?
Wow, I mean, am I internationally renowned? I think I might be. That's like, I'm going to try not to let that go to my head, but it is similar to the time someone sent me an email calling me a thought leader, and I had to bring it up in conversation a lot with my husband. But hi, everybody. My name is Amanda Lee McCarty. I use all three of my names because there are a lot of other Amanda McCartys in this world, and one of them is really good at softball, so I don't want you to mix up our talents. I live on a farm in rural Pennsylvania, which I'm sure is going to come up in our conversation today because I was lucky enough to host Maggie there just a few months ago. Yet my superpower is that I'm a speed reader. I have a Hello Kitty tattoo. I have 4 cats that live in my house. I am married to a fabulous individual named Dustin. And yeah, I've been making Clothes Horse since 2020.
Which is right around the time that we met. We've known each other all these years, which is awesome.
Definitely.
Pennsylvania, I know, is not where you started. You've kind of been moving around a little bit.
Yes.
Thinking about this concept of like self-awareness, self-reflection, you have shared so many things about yourself. And I'm curious if there's something that you find particularly unique or something that has deep meaning for you, something that makes you different. Maybe it has to do with your podcast.
I mean, you know, it's interesting. I mean, not to spoil this for the listeners, but before Maggie and I sat down to record this, Maggie, like any fine podcast host, sent me a list of things we were going to discuss. And it got a lot of wheels turning for me about like, who am I? Right? Because I spend a lot of my time focusing on everything else that is happening around me, the people that I know personally and the people I'll never meet, what's happening in this world, our planet. And that's what a lot of my work on Clothes Horse is about. So I rarely just sit down and think like, who am I? And I think that I have many positive attributes. I have many negative attributes. I'm a really good cook and I have very strong math skills. I'm quite an expert on Excel and I really am obsessed with collecting artificial fruit, and perhaps all of those things individually are not very special, but I think they really come together to form a unique person that is me.
When I'm thinking about you, this work that you're doing, the platform that you have, something that came to mind is this concept of finding your voice. Certainly, as a podcast host, you have a lot to say. You're doing a lot of talking. You're using this tool as in your voice. And I'm super curious what your experience has been in finding that. Was it natural? Was it easy? Was it always like this? Did this experience with the podcast help you connect with it in a different way? Tell me about your voice.
Sure. So I'll start this. I'm going to say something to you, Maggie, and to all of your listeners that I certainly have never said publicly, but I also have never said aloud to anyone. And it's going to sound like I'm bragging, but I promise that I will make you understand why what I'm about to tell you has made me quite silent for most of my life. Okay. And that is that I am a highly intelligent person. And it feels like such a boast to say that out loud. But this recognition that I was a highly intelligent person began when I was a really small child. It began as soon as I started school, and I was constantly, overhearing conversations that my mother was having with my grandparents about how they wanted to move me ahead in grades or try to send me to college early or send me away to a special school. I grew up in a very rural area where, I mean, the biggest town I lived in growing up had 600 people, but most of the time we never lived in a town. So we're dealing with like rural school districts in a time, and I don't know if it's much better now, where if you were anything outside of the norm, schools kind of didn't know what to do with you, right? And so there were several years of elementary school where I just hung out in the library all day doing independent study, which to be fair, I really loved because I love a library. I love reading. I love hanging out with librarians. It's actually like a pretty good situation that I remember quite fondly. But this issue of me being a very intelligent person was a source of shame. And I think some of this you're going to relate to, Maggie, and your listeners are going to relate to this too. Of course, there was the personal, like familial issues of it, which my mom, like I'm no contact with my mom. I'm very public about that on Closed Horse. My mom had a serious issue with me being smart and didn't want it to ever come up in conversation, discouraged me from ever talking about anything that made me sound smart, and largely was like, you talk too much, just be quiet. So at home, I'm already learning this sort of like shame of sounding smart, of sharing what you've learned or know. I mean, like already this like pressure at home. The only times where it would really like, I don't know, I was allowed to be smart, I guess, for lack of a better phrase here, is when I was hanging out with my grandparents, who they loved nothing more to brag to near strangers, acquaintances. It didn't matter about how smart I was. They would be like, this kid right here, genius IQ. IQ as high as Einstein's. Like they loved it. My grandpa Les would love me to like do math problems for his friends, I was like in early elementary school helping my grandma do the books for her business, like they just like loved that about me. But when I was at home, which is where I was most of the time, if I wasn't at school, it was like a shameful topic. So that was that aspect of it. But then there was the social part of it, right? And I think anybody who's listening to this who has been assigned female at birth knows that if you are assigned female at birth, there is this pressure to not be smart, that the social pressure is to be pretty and accommodating, maybe quiet unless spoken to, but certainly never smart. And certainly never the smartest person in the room, or even implying to anyone that you might know stuff, right? And the social pressure pretty early on at school was really overwhelming for me because anyone who was in class with me knew that I was like the smart kid who never really had to like work very hard and always got the highest score on every test and won the spelling bee and won the science fair and pretty effortlessly. And that was not a good thing. If I were a boy, if I had been assigned male at birth, Most certainly, my mom would have been bragging about it to everyone. It wouldn't have been a weird issue at home. At school, people would have been like, oh, he's just the smart kid, right? I'm sure I would have had all these other opportunities that came my way as well, because there has always certainly been this expectation that the smartest person in the room should be a guy, right? And so at school, I felt like, okay, don't try too hard. Don't raise your hand very often to answer questions. Don't talk in general. Just be as quiet as possible. And as I moved into adolescence, like I really remember someone saying to me in seventh grade, boys don't like smart girls. You need to just try to be pretty instead, you know? And so I want people to want to date me, although I don't know what I thought that was when I was 12, but I want it to be appealing to people, you know? And so it was like, okay, I got to start acting dumb. And I'm going to tell you, Maggie, literal, like concerted effort to sound not smart all the time. It changed the way I spoke, my mannerisms, just how I positioned myself in social situations. And because that was so energy consuming and gave me a lot of anxiety, what it did is ultimately over time just make me stop talking in social situations, particularly around boys and men. And as I became a young adult, what I found is that I would frequently get involved with men who were a lot older than me who wanted to just like teach me things, you know? And I would already know it, but have to be silent and like wide-eyed and shocked and amazed by and so privileged to learn these things from, you know? And that, like, I couldn't have an opinion on art or movies or books or music because it certainly could never be as wise as their opinions, right? And I just was a really quiet person. I would say that a lot of people who dated me for a really long time, regardless of their gender, didn't really know me or anything about me, what I really liked, what I thought about, you know, but I actually, like, I read a ton of books. I have very strong feelings on music. I like to learn several new things every day. Learning is like to me one of life's simplest pleasures. And for a long time, I kind of had to keep that secret. And so starting Clothes Horse, it sounded like a great idea in theory, right? Like I wanted to talk to people about what was really happening with the clothing that they buy because I'd worked in that industry. I hated how it had this mystique of glamour and necessity. In a weird way, everything about fashion as it portrays itself, it kind of reflected all of the social pressures I felt growing up as a person assigned female at birth. It was more important to be pretty and thin, small and quiet and nice and pleasing to others, not necessarily to yourself. You know, all of that stuff, like that's what the fashion industry is. But it's also like, you know, destroying the planet and exploiting humans. I wanted to start Clothes Horse, and I immediately, as I sat down to write the first episode, I realized like, oh my God, I'm gonna talk out loud about something that matters to me. Have I ever really done this before? Is that gonna be uncomfortable? And early on, I felt as if I couldn't make things personal, like really interject myself into it too much because I felt that people wouldn't take me seriously. I don't know why I thought that. I mean, yeah, well, like, you know, decades of socialization as a person assigned female at birth, you feel like people are not going to take you seriously. And I noticed over time that when I was vulnerable and really spoke from my own life experience, it resonated more with people, right? They wanted to hear more what I had to say. And that was motivating, but also sort of liberating for me because I have felt since I was a small child that no one wanted to hear what I had to say. And the best way I could stay safe, whatever that means, was to just be quiet, be agreeable, right? Be the smallest, quietest, meekest person in the room rather than the smartest person in the room. And not only has Clothes Horse helped me find my voice and feel good, kind of powerful speaking out loud, understanding the significance of not only the stories of everyone around me and everybody who comes on Clothes Horse, but also the importance of my own stories. It has also let me say and be comfortable, like with saying, hey, I'm like a highly intelligent person, which once again, I even feel like I have to apologize, like not bragging, guys, you know, but just accepting that fact is, it took me this many years to be like, yeah, I'm pretty smart. Cool, live with it, you know?
So my first question is, how does that feel right now? How do the words feel in your mouth? How does it feel to share that out loud for the first time ever?
Well, my first feeling saying it out loud was like, man, everybody's going to press stop and not finish listening to this episode. But once again, I think that is like, we're not ever, especially if you've been assigned female birth, you're like not allowed to be proud of who you are. I feel like you're always supposed to be striving to be more attractive, to be thinner, to be more desirable to whomever is the target audience for that, your desirability. You're supposed to always be thinking about how other people feel before yourself, right? You're not really supposed to have ambition. Now, I think all of this stuff is bullshit. And I can say that I want all of us to go out there and be our true selves and live our best lives and have dreams and like make our dreams come true and do the best things we can do. But I believe that and strongly support everyone who's doing that, but I myself will find myself being like, well, except for you, Amanda. You need to shut up.
Let me just say, like, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And also, it is an incredible joy to bear witness to this right now. Like, you taking ownership of it and actually embracing that about yourself. It's not going to surprise you. Like, a lot of what you shared as far as your childhood experience with that fact about yourself is very familiar to me. And I was thinking as you were talking about the different experiences at home versus school and like changing your behavior to sort of suit whatever expectations were happening around you, particularly because of your assigned identity. I was thinking about my own experience feeling always less than, certainly othered, but in retrospect, like I can see it was a threat to the people around me, which is,
Yes.
it's not a me problem, right? Like the empath in me can see very clearly that that kind of treatment, that kind of cruelty, and frankly, abuse comes from a deep, deep, generations deep place of insecurity, which is certainly something I can identify with. Like that treatment, the pressure, all those things you're describing created that later in life, bred insecurity. And I think it's remarkable that you're in a place in your life, in your own adulthood and autonomy, where you can call these things what they were, you can name them, and also maybe reclaim some of that power. You use the word power, which I thought was really interesting. All I ever wanted growing up was to be smart, to be thought of as smart, and I was, right? In certain environments, I certainly was. School in particular, very similar experience with like, references to high IQ, and we want to, put her in a grade or two up, or start high school early, all those things. And it was those experiences were denied, like I was denied them because of the threat that it presented, right? Like,
Absolutely. That's what I think too, Maggie. I mean, as a kid, I think as a kid I wasn't supposed to know that these conversations were happening. But I was very aware of it. I'm sure you were the same way. I listen, adults out there, kids listen to what you're saying even when you're not talking directly to them, okay? So they hear it. If you're on the phone with someone or you're in the other room drinking, international coffees with your mother or aunt or whomever, your kids hear what you're saying, right? So I heard the conversations. I knew that there was this pressure coming from the school and like the school psychologist and whatnot to push me forward. And my mom was like, no, that's just not happening. And at the time as a kid, I was like, well, my mom, you know how I mean, I don't, I feel like you probably would have a similar, I may have had a similar sort of reaction to this kind of thing, Maggie, but hearing my mom tell my grandmother or my aunt that there was no way they were gonna, like, she was gonna let me skip a grade or go to high school early or all these other things. For me, what it said to me, it's because my mom knows that I am this defective person who cannot handle that I'm too weird, that I'm too small for my age, that I'm too this, I'm too that. That's why I can't do that. And so that actually just like exacerbated my insecurity. I know that exactly what you're saying is true, that there was this intimidation of it all. My mother was a teenager when I was born. I was diagnosed with cancer when I was a year and a half old. And so on top of everything else, there was always, my mother was very vocal about this with me. there was this feeling on her part that the moment I came into this world, I stole all of the attention from her, that I consumed all the oxygen in the room at all times just by existing. And I think me being a smart kid just made that worse.
Oh my God, like, talk about resonating. There's an uglier practical side to this too that might be actionable for listeners or actionable for parents out there. Like, I think the fact that she was really young when she had you, right?
Yeah.
That's a symptom of our generation as well. My mom was young, not a fully developed, self-actualized adult, certainly, right? Like,
No, teen. I mean, I feel like I think that when I turned 18, I thought I was like a big, smart grown up. I was a child. I
absolutely.
look back, oh my gosh, a child.
And of course, everything is clearer in hindsight, right?
Yes.
But
Yeah.
I can see like the threat aspect, the intimidation aspect, and also like this is going to take way too much work. Like, this means that I am going to have to make way more concessions and compromises than I have up to this point, like, let alone keeping them fed. And even that, like, we're going to talk about food, I think, later, food insecurity a little bit. Like, meeting basic needs was not consistent in my life. That's,
Same, yeah.
but it's like, it's going to take so much more. Like, that work, I mean, I'll just put it bluntly, like, that is the job. That's the gig. When you sign up
Yeah.
for parenthood, you don't get to choose what child comes into your life. They are their own person, and it's your responsibility to nurture them on every level, not just basic needs, but at the very least, don't discourage the things that make them special, that they get excited about, bring them joy. Like, I can hear as you're reflecting on your childhood it was taken away from you. You were shamed for it. I definitely empathize with that. It's fucked up.
It is fucked up. And I think it is a generational thing as well. I like to hope that the parents of our generation are doing a better job. But you and I and many of our peers growing up, we were parentified really early on. I would just like to thank the internet for coming up with that term and using it so often on Reddit that I was finally able to identify that, yeah, you're right. It was weird for me to be doing all the housework and cooking and babysitting in third grade. I see that now. But that was my life growing up, like felt that I often was treated as an adult, except for when it came to my actual like rights or freedom, right? All the work of an adult, all the worries of an adult, none of the privileges of being an adult, And I just want our generation to do better at that. I mean, I have worked very hard to do that with my child, and I hope that everyone else is trying to, like, we have to end these cycles. I think our parents, many of them were just doing what they had experienced growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. And acknowledging that generational piece, I think, is really important. Also, just to kind of give some listeners hope, Amanda, I've not met your child, right? But I have other peers, right? My age, close to my age, that have children. And it's wild because it's so new and different to see like a healthy model.
No, true story.
There is hope. The cycles have been stopped or at least intervened significantly such that, things are changing. The language, you brought up that, like, we have more language to describe our experience. People are talking about things more, which is definitely night and day from what I experienced with my parents, but previous generations. I mean, can you imagine how buttoned up and, forced to hide and just minimizing their lives, their selves.
Yeah, it makes me really sad.
There is hope. You're here. You are a grown ass adult using your voice in really powerful ways. I just think that's amazing. Thank
I
you.
mean, thank you. Well, thank you for sort of forcing me to reflect on all of this because, I'm gonna be honest. I mean, we're gonna get into this later, I know, but like the work I do with Clothes Horse is it's a lot. And that's not my paying job, which we'll talk about more later. So I work two full-time jobs, basically. And so I often just don't get the luxury of sitting down and like thinking about things outside of that. And just for any of your listeners who are wondering, I have most certainly been to therapy. Okay. I think actually I'm able to talk about these things and think them through in productive ways because I've been to therapy. But after feeling silent for so long, and that being my comfortable place for so long, my feeling of perceived safety, I guess we'll say, less comfortable, more just safe. And then slowly, like discovering that voice, I take the privilege of that very, very seriously. And I mean, you know this, Maggie. I will not say anything publicly that I don't know is based, for sure, is based in facts that hasn't been thought through quite a bit before speaking it out loud, because I don't want to accidentally hurt others. I don't want to spread misinformation. And I generally just want to be a person that others can trust, that when I say something, I mean it and I know it. And I think we don't live in a world right now where that is the case for most of what we hear, whether it's on, social media or even on other podcasts or, I mean, on the news, like we get a lot of people who aren't necessarily fact-checking what they say before they say it, right? Or thinking about the impact of what they say before they say it. Growing up in my household, I learned pretty early on that the words you say, they affect people, right? And so the best thing you can do when you are in a moment of just like overwhelming emotion, good or bad about anything, is take a minute to think about things before you say it. Like definitely growing up, I was like, wow, I can see how people say mean things when they're upset that they shouldn't say, and then they swirl around in your head for the rest of your life that you heard those mean things from that person, or maybe you said the mean things and they're still swirling around in your head and coming up just at the moment you're about to fall asleep every night. And so initially, it was like, I don't want to say things that would be hurtful. But then it expanded into like, I don't want to say things that aren't true, because so much of the information I encounter on a day-to-day basis would be more like information in quotation marks and not like real factual information. And in the world I work in of like sustainability and anti-capitalism and just fighting for a better world, through collective action, it's really important that we have our facts straight.
Trust is everything. I mean,
Yeah.
not to get meta, but let's get meta and let's get even more meta. Like, trust is really the foundation of this entire show concept. The preserving confidentiality is like part of that, but it is really, like you were saying, being careful and thoughtful and taking a minute before actually speaking. And honestly, we're both kind of word nerds. I don't mean to be, the cliche about like actions and words and actions having deeper meaning. It's like, unless you're me or you, in which case those words will stick with us. Like, and they do. I think that's a universal human experience. Like, bruises heal, right? Wounds heal, but the words, the language, how you talk to someone, how you treat someone verbally, how you write about them or yourself, whatever that is, like it can have a lasting impact. And you mentioned social media, right? We're in a digital world now. Like, stuff exists forever, you know?
Yeah. No, and I think social media, I think that's a great segue into that, because I think that I have a complicated relationship with social media, as probably everyone listening to this conversation does at this point. And prior to starting Close Horse, like, was I involved in social media? Sure. I totally posted pictures of my cats and my trips and my friends, rarely food photos, because the most delicious food usually doesn't photograph very well. And I think we all need to accept that. But I was posting photos and just sharing with my friends and commenting on my friends and like being social. I never really saw that I would have any like deeper relationship or involvement with social media beyond that. And when I started making Close Horse, about a month into it, I was like, oh, I should start like an Instagram account for this, just so people know there's episodes. It's a standard free marketing kind of situation. And what happened pretty fast is that really what I found was this other platform for sharing information. And in fact, yes, lots of people listen to Close Horse, but there are a lot of people who just follow Close Horse on social media and have never listened to an episode. So, the challenge there was like, how do I take all these big things they talk about in these episodes and distill them into little carousels on Instagram, which is very challenging. But really, the real challenge is dealing with being a person on the internet, as I call it. This is a role that I have to take on. And as a person on the internet, I find social media to be a really brutal and frustrating place. I believe in its ability as a way to share information and bring people together. I 100% believe in that. I think it is very important now more than ever because so many people, and I'm not saying I like this, but so many people get their news and information from social media, not from reading newspapers or magazines or books or blogs or even watching news programming. They're getting it from social media. And there's a lot of incorrect information on all the platforms. I think TikTok is the most egregious, but like across the board, so much misinformation. That makes me take that responsibility seriously. Like, okay, I'm going to keep sticking it out on these platforms just to be like one of the people who's like really, really trying to keep things honest and reliable. And I gotta tell you, some of the meanest things that anyone has ever said to me have happened on Instagram or TikTok because I am a person like you, Maggie. Words are really powerful. And when someone sends me a nasty DM or leaves a mean comment, it is very hurtful to me. There are still a few interactions that I've had on social media over the past few years that I would classify as traumatic because they come up all the time in my mind and sometimes make me cry. And definitely have forced me to really confront my imposter syndrome right on and be like, people don't get to say that stuff to me. I think there is also this belief out there that if you are on the internet, then you are signing some sort of unspoken contract that people can be horrible to you and you have to take it. And I'm not okay with that. Going back to how Close Horse has helped me find my voice and recognize all these things about myself, it has also forced me to not develop thicker skin. I'm still highly sensitive, okay? Highly sensitive, and I have no apologies for that. But it has allowed me to see that what people say online is often just this one corner of their brain that's getting something out, and that, like, it doesn't mean it's okay. But to recognize that, like, while social media to me is very much real life, there is this sort of weird fantasy element of it where everybody's acting like it's just a game of Sims.
Yeah, that concept that you just touched on, the social media world in contrast with, let's call it the real world, just for
Yeah.
this conversation, we're definitely going to dig into that a little bit. I was thinking more like practical, tactical terms as far as what's involved in podcasting, but even more interesting to me and probably listeners as well as this emotional impact.
Attention Confidential is sponsored, produced, and distributed by Self Magnitude LLC, an ethical microbusiness on a mission to transform how you see yourself. It is hosted by Maggie Green, personal brand and style strategist for weirdos and queerdos of all ages and gender expressions, who is also the face and voice behind Self Magnitude, helping people feel seen since 2020. If you're looking for support on embodying all aspects of your identity, and showing up as your radically authentic self in person, in print, and online, please visit Maggie's 100% DIY website at selfmagnitude.com.
Putting your voice out there, that's a huge leap, right? There's also that element of like an invitation for feedback. We'll call it feedback.
Yeah. Unsolicited advice, perhaps. I get a lot of that. First off, no human brain was designed to get unsolicited feedback 24/7, mostly from strangers. Okay. is very, very hard. And of course, I get mean DMs from people. Some stuff that people have said to me online, I can't even like say out loud because I would probably start crying. Frequently, people, you know, if someone wants to show up and say I'm stupid or I made a typo or they don't agree with me, that's one thing. But I will tell you, and I think this comes back to presenting as a very femme person, lots of people just show up to tell me that I'm ugly. Like, honestly, I get that all the time, which, you know, is hurtful because I've been conditioned to believe that I need to be pretty, right? But I guess also if your takeaway from my work is that I am not attractive, then maybe you weren't the right audience in the first place. But what does it mean to make a podcast in 2025, right? I think on one side of it, there is like the psychosocial element of it, of dealing with social media, of dealing with strangers, weird feedback from people, or hurtful things, just sometimes being as a stranger to someone like at the other end of their frustrations, right? There also is this reality that podcasting, while 100% a full-time job if you want to do it well, is not a paying job right now, unless. And even still, I say this with a hard unless, but with the caveat that unless you're willing to sacrifice your values. But I'll just say that even if you are, they're probably not going to pay you enough to make it worth your while. Like, if you want to make money as a podcaster, there are a few ways you can do it, right? One is that you can have a Patreon, but it's really difficult to get people to sign up for that because the landscape is so crowded. And, you know, I've been doing Clothes Horse for 5 years. I, at most, have ever had 100 supporters on Patreon. Like, it's just not successful for me. I think if I made it my full-time job, maybe it could be more so, but I just doubt that at this point. So how else do podcasters make money? Well, they make money via advertising. There's a whole conversation going on in the world of podcasting, which is basically like, there's this podcast industrial complex where you pay fees for just about everything to have your podcast hosted, for the editing software, for the transcription software, you know, on and on and on. You know, when people listen to your podcast on any platform, you don't get paid for it, right? It's like free to the listeners. But if you want to make a little bit of money, you can allow them to insert advertising, these like dynamic ads, which you don't get any say in. And what they are. I mean, you a little bit. You can be like, don't put ads about guns or something. But in general, you're going to get a lot of ads because this is where the advertising money is coming from online casinos and election ads and fast fashion companies and diet stuff, right? These are all things. I don't want any of these things, right? On Clothes Horse. And here's the thing. As a podcaster, you're going to be like, well, I should make some money for my work. I agree 100%. You're going to get paid 1 cent a listen to take these shitty ads on your podcast. You're going to be like, I'm going to put in even more ads. And you still will be like, wow, I make 10 cents every time someone listens to this podcast. Like, what? That's nothing. And did I mention that, like, probably the payment platform is going to take a chunk of that too? So it's just like, maybe you made 7 cents. It's really silly. And so I do not make Clothes Horse because I am hoping to get rich. I work a full-time job in addition to it. What is frustrating about it is that I don't think a lot of people who listen recognize that like I usually work 12 hours a day. I only take one day off a week, and sometimes I work, that's on Saturday. Sometimes I work Saturday nights because there is the podcast production itself. There are the administrative tasks, right? There are creating the social media posts. There's the recording and the outreach and the editing and the ideating and the research and the reading and on and on and on. And this is work that I do. Well, I hate the administrative stuff, but everything else, I do this work with joy because, as I mentioned earlier, I like to learn a few new things every day. And this is how I do that. And I look at Clothes Horse as also a creative outlet for myself. I'm not just like recording some conversations and throwing it up into the cloud. Like, there is a strong narrative that I envision in the beginning that I sort of tour us through as we're recording, and then I edit and solidify and do more research and kind of pull together to tell that story in the end. And the average episode on its own is generally 30 hours of work from beginning to end. And that's not including any other content I create for social media every day of the week, right? So it's a lot of work. And I will tell you, I finally have started to say no to people who want to come on Clothes Horse. If I'm going to put 30 hours of unpaid work into something, I better enjoy doing it. It better be a story that I'm interested in. It better be like creatively inspiring for me. it better guide me somewhere to learn something new. And, you know, this will start happening to you, Maggie, as you release episodes. You're going to start getting emails from PR people who want to put the CEO on your podcast, or people will be like, "Hey, my brand is not doing well. Could you get me on there?" And I can't do 30 hours of free advertising for people, you know? So I hope I didn't just depress everybody, because, like I said, I am glad to do this work. And I think if you are passionate about something, it is fun and rewarding to do this kind of work until it isn't. And you have to recognize that and take a break or do what you need to do to get re-inspired. And that's my advice for anyone who wants to do this. Don't come in thinking that you're going to quit your job and podcast, because you're probably not. You might prove me wrong, but like, the days of getting rich from podcasting are kind of over. And I get at least one email a month from someone who has been inspired by listening to Clothes Horse to quit their job and become a podcaster. And I'm like, whoa, 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 it's not going to work. Even if your podcast is very successful and can become an income stream for you, it is years off in the future because it takes a long time to build that audience. You shouldn't podcast because you're thinking it's going to be an income stream. You should podcast because you have a story to tell and you like talking to other people and you like sharing information, or it's a topic that you're really passionate about, or you just want an excuse to talk to your friends about movies you watch together. That alone is a viable reason to start a podcast. Go do it.
I appreciate the insight from the production side of things. And I think there's some takeaways for listeners as well, right? Like what you see, the final cut, you know, just a couple of clicks and you're entertained for hours every single week, around the clock. There's so much that had to happen before that could take place. The hours of research, this isn't even a to-do list. This is like, all of these areas are separate work streams that have tons of tasks and subtasks and dependencies. I think the average listener completely takes that for granted. Generally speaking, if there are people out there introducing you to new things, educating you, entertaining you for the sheer joy of it, now you know there's no money in it at all. That's not why we're doing what we're doing, but show up for them. And the ways that you can do that, obviously financial support, sharing with your networks, but particularly the financial piece, like prove it, you know, if you love Clothes Horse so much, prove it.
I have lower expectations around this, Maggie, where I'm like, listen, if you can't afford to support Clothes Horse, I get it. None of us are really like thriving financially right now, but like, share stuff, recommend it to people, share what you've learned with other people, and respect my time. Respect me as a human. I work as a consultant with a wide variety of small businesses, and I am full-time employed by it, which is incredible. I get to work from home all day with Brenda, my cat, and it is just like, I can't believe I'm this lucky. After 2 decades of working in the corporate environment, it is so refreshing. But as part of that job, I have a calendar link on my website, my professional website, that you can use to book onboarding meetings, like if you're interested in learning more about working with me, right? And I had this problem a few months ago where Clothes Horse listeners were booking meetings using that just to hang out, not to pay me for my time or anything like that. And I had to finally be like, hey, so I was very kind and I didn't say anything about how frustrated I was, but I was stewing inwardly because I was like, this is an hour of my day when I could actually be working and I need this hour to work for money to pay my bills, you know? And that was really frustrating to me. And I remember kind of having like a little bit of a mini breakdown over it, where I was like, I feel like people think I'm just a doll for their entertainment. And whenever they want to play with me, they just take me off the shelf. Like, I'm not a person with a life outside of this. And I think that's just a really common part of like the parasocialness of the internet. There is like a scarcity mindset and the kind of it's unavoidable, I think, for a lot of people who are writers, podcasters, content creators, influencers, whatever you want to call them, in that space where there's very little money to go around, right? And it creates this like hyper competitive ugliness. I want to be clear to anybody who's listening to this. I don't really care if I make money off of Clothes Horse. I mean, would I love for it to be my full-time paying job? Of course, but that ship has sailed. I don't think that's going to happen. There are so many people on this planet who have not, I mean, like the number of people on this planet who have heard what I have to say. This is a very small, not even like a decimal point of the people on this planet, right? So we actually need everybody, as many people as possible out here spreading this kind of messaging and sharing what they've learned with other people and being loud about it. And so I am personally like, I don't care if I make any money off of this. Can we just please get more and more people talking about this? There's room for everybody. Everybody is invited.
I love that, especially the reference to scarcity mindset, right? The other side of that spectrum is abundance, which the implication is that there's enough to go around. And it's true. I think, you've referenced anti-capitalism as well. You've mentioned values. These are all things that we share. And so I can say, like, yeah, I mean, maybe it is my own privilege talking, and I have worked really hard, and I've been in scarcely resourced situations in all different contexts of my life. Capitalism trains us to believe that it's all shaped like a pie, right? And there's only so much to go around. Notion of collaboration, sharing generously, it fosters a culture totally different than what we're experiencing now, which, I mean, social media content creation is totally like a brilliant microcosm of all of the things that are shitty about that. Like,
True story, yeah.
more today than ever. It's part of the reason, certainly part of the inspiration for my stepping back, right? Like, I don't have a social media presence apart from whatever archive posts are up there a year ago and before. But yeah, I think you touched on something really important, which is, yeah, an abundance. That's a buzzword too. I'm not sure I love it, but the spirit of it, right? That we are all in this together. And sometimes, especially in the absence of financial resources, the best thing you can do is help spread the message, help to educate people, information available. I think that's really important. And yeah, if it's not clear, I'm not doing this for the money. It's because it's exciting. I love people. I love talking about feelings, and I don't have a whole lot of space in my personal and professional life to just do.
Yeah.
Create that. And for folks out there who are similarly passionate about whatever it is, like, this is certainly an avenue. And there's responsibility and privilege attached to, like, if you build a platform, it's important to think about what you want to say, what you want to leave people with. And yeah, harm reduction. You didn't say that explicitly, but that's something that's important to me.
Same. You don't have to start a podcast or spend copious hours every week making posts in Photoshop. No one expects that from you, right? But just taking what you've learned and speaking out about it loudly to people around you is kind of one of the most effective things you can do, right? And I'm not just talking about posting on social media. I'm talking like taking that into the real world and having one-on-one conversations with your friends and your family and your coworkers, because those conversations are so impactful. Maggie and I have already talked in this conversation about the impact of words. And I'll tell you, like words in a conversation, those are what really plant the seeds of change, even less than a social media post. Like anytime I make an episode of Close Horse or do a post on social media, my hope is that really someone takes that offline. Right, and has conversations with the people around them. I don't know. Maybe they can hear this conversation, like what they've learned, and it'll have an impact on them. And so I think, yes, I am this person who exists on the internet, but I am also a person who exists in the real world, so to speak. And I try to carry that sort of activism, that drive to start conversations into my external world as well.
Definitely one of the things I admire most about you, why I was excited to have you on the show. I value your time, your work, your brain, your big, beautiful brain. You mentioned activism. Our next segment, our final segment, was the megaphone, the metaphorical soapbox. And I think there are lots of calls to action and insights just baked into today's conversation that'll give listeners something to think about, something to take away. I'm really curious if you had something to share about Scream It From the Rooftops, what might that be? There was a little spoiler earlier in our conversation. It may or may not have something to do with food.
It does, yes. And I think people probably expected me to start talking to you all about like fast fashion or legislation around that, but I contain multitudes. And I actually do want to talk to you about food and access to food. No, this isn't like a seed oils or poison conversation or anything like that. I actually just want to talk to you about how much food scarcity there's here in the United States, and I would suspect in other countries as well. According to Feeding America, 47 million people in the United States are food insecure, which means they're skipping meals, right? They may not have enough food in the first place, and just eating is difficult because they don't have the financial resources for that. And people who don't have access to regular, consistent food are all around you, and you may not be able to spot them because I think that food insecurity, the lack of resources to buy food, is one of those things that we kind of hide because we're ashamed of it. And I've been on SNAP, also known as food stamps, although they haven't been an actual piece of paper for a really long time, right? But it's the food assistance benefits that are a part of the social safety net here in the United States. There were times where I would not have been able to eat without that assistance. There are times when I could not get that assistance for various reasons, when I could not afford to eat. And I will just say, we're not going to talk about like current political climate here in the United States or anything like that. And I will just tell you that in this century, regardless who has been the president of the United States, getting food assistance has been really, really challenging for a lot of different reasons, right? Like there is an enormous amount of paperwork involved. The income limits make no sense. The example that I often cite is that I was getting a small amount of food assistance while I was working full time with a child and making $8 an hour. When I got a $1 raise, I lost my food assistance, which actually was the food assistance for the month. My like SNAP benefits were actually more than that $1 an hour raise was. So it actually set me back. I remember specifically when I moved to Philadelphia to begin my buying career. I got a $4,000 raise to move across the country to live in a city that was far more expensive. Making $4,000 more, of course, meant that I was not qualified for SNAP benefits. But I had such little money that what I would do is every few days for myself, go to the Dollar Tree and buy a thing of ramen and a thing of canned vegetables, and I would make that last for 3 days. Like that's, I didn't look hungry to the outside world. And here I was going to an office job every day and I couldn't afford food. And so I would like you, if you have the resources yourself, to help others access food, right? There are so many ways you can do it. One is that you can put food in free fridges in your area. Perhaps you could be motivated to start your own free fridge. Even in my neighborhood in Austin, we didn't have a fridge in my neighborhood, but we had sort of like a food cabinet where you could put extra things that you had, non-perishable, non-refrigerated items. And there was nothing better than going over there and putting in a few extra things that I had picked up at Costco and seeing someone come and take it. I was like, yay, like this is amazing, right? This is like what society is helping people out when you have extra, giving it to someone who doesn't, right? And that's one opportunity where you can directly just put some food in someone else's hands. I also say, donate to your local food bank because let me tell you, they are not getting the funding they need. They're getting less funding than ever. And a lot of people rely on food banks because it is not, the paperwork isn't this egregious nightmare like it is to get SNAP. Also, SNAP benefits are often delayed. They're often not enough. There are only certain places you can spend it. Sometimes there are many issues with like our social safety net here, and food banks really fill that void for a lot of people. Now, I talked to some friends who are volunteers at various food banks, which, by the way, is another thing you could do is volunteer at a food bank. And they told me that they prefer that people donate money, not just dropping off what you had extra in your cabinets, mostly because people tend to donate weird stuff that they didn't want to eat. Like, nobody wants your can of artichokes that you bought like last year because you thought maybe you were going to make dip with them. Nobody wants the random can of peas that you, I mean, I would probably eat them. I like a canned pea. I'm not ashamed to admit it. But in general, food banks would rather have money because they have relationships in place where they can buy a lot of food for a little bit of money in comparison to like the prices you and I pay at the grocery store. So please just like, give, if you have any bit of extra resources that you can use to put food in the hands of others, rather than donating money to like a large national organization, I would recommend you, get out the internet and search for a local food bank. And those can be associated with churches and other religious groups, but they can also be non-denominational and more just generally like we feed people. Most likely, probably where you live, there are a variety of different options for food banks that you could support. There are also groups that tend to focus on, like, I'm thinking top of mind Food Not Bombs, which I'm sure, Maggie, you're familiar with as well. These are people who are volunteering and literally cooking food and serving it often at public parks, usually to unhoused people, but really like anyone is welcome to come and get a meal. Those are options too for volunteering or just, throwing some money their way. I cannot underscore how many people are not. They're not getting like their 3 meals a day because they just don't have the money or access to it. Food is, we need it to survive. Like, it shouldn't be that way. We should all have all the food we want, and we should all have a nice place to live and access to good education and healthcare and all these other things that are really just the basic premise of a healthy, happy, good life, which every human deserves. But unfortunately, we don't have the infrastructure in place for that. And I grew up pretty poor, powdered milk kind of poor. And like we had a lot of food scarcity at our house growing up. I don't think I was aware of it as a kid, but sometimes there would literally be nothing in the refrigerator. We used to eat this like white gravy that was just basically flour and margarine, maybe with a splash of milk. And we would just eat that on toast, like, because that's all we had, right? I felt like I knew the social safety net really well, and I knew what it was to be hungry. And then the pandemic came, and I think for a lot of us, regardless of what our personal experiences were during the pandemic, which is still not over, those early years of the pandemic, we really exposed some of the flaws in our society and the social safety net and the government and how it all performs. I lost my job almost immediately as the pandemic began, and I was thrown into this disaster that was the unemployment system in Pennsylvania, but like this was a theme repeating itself in every state here in the United States. And I actually didn't get my first unemployment payment for 6 months. It was horrible. We were in a really bad situation. We had to move. We were like, no doctor's appointments, nothing. We can't do anything. We just have to like stay here and make the best of our situation. But I was lucky because my partner was still working. Not exactly full time, but there was some money coming into our house. And I was feeling so frustrated with the unemployment system here in Pennsylvania and nationally that I realized that I was having difficulty navigating it, but I'm a really technologically savvy person. For people who aren't super techie or have a lot of discomfort with the sort of verbiage and forms and everything that you have to complete to possibly get some unemployment benefits. And so I found myself joining all these different Facebook groups for people who had lost their jobs and helping them file for unemployment, having one-on-one phone calls with people where I walk them through and help them fill out their forms. And as a part of these groups, I was also starting to see how our social safety net fails people all the time because of the way it is structured, because a lot of these people weren't getting SNAP benefits because they couldn't get them until their unemployment benefits were processed. And the unemployment system was backed up, so people had no couldn't get processed for SNAP and then therefore had no money and no food. And they couldn't go to a food bank to pick up food because maybe there wasn't one nearby, or they couldn't afford gas for their car to go get food at the food bank, or maybe that food bank only allowed people to come once a week. And people were going hungry. And what was happening in this Facebook group is people were Venmoing people $10 to go get some gas so they could drive to the food bank, or dropping off diapers and other foods at people's houses. And just like I saw this enormous community forming out of strangers who the only thing they had in common was that they didn't have a job anymore and were thrown into these like wild circumstances. And for me, that was when I was like, okay, I get it now. I get that we can't rely on these systems to take care of us. But what we can rely on is one another. And so it's important for all of us to step up and be an active member of the communities around us.
Showing up for each other. Huge.
Yeah, it's huge. This world is built upon people doing good things and caring for one another around them. So don't give up.
The original music, as featured on Attention Confidential, was written, composed, and produced by Christopher Colley Biondi, a deaf pianist, composer, and dear friend in Central Kentucky, who generously provided his skills and talent to support the launch of this podcast. That's all for this episode of Attention Confidential, but of course, the conversation doesn't end here. I encourage you to keep exploring, keep questioning, and most of all, keep sharing your stories. If today's conversation spoke to you, please pass it on. And if you have a story of your own you'd like to showcase, I am here and ready to listen. You can find all past and future episodes at selfmagnitude.com/podcast. And until next time, remember this: your voice matters.